Welcome on to the Dunked On Basketball podcast after a spectacular game two. Again, just barely starting to calm down after getting back from the arena. I'm joined by a new guest this time, one of the finest basketball minds Canada has produced, Doug Eberhardt, a former NBA assistant coach in Summer League, a skills development guy, and a good pal of mine as well, a great guy to watch a game with. And also famous for his ATO breakdowns on SB Nation and a host on NBC Sports Radio. Doug, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well, Nathan. Thank you for that introduction. I can already tell you're delusional from Oracle Arena just by the saying that I'm one of the finest basketball minds in Canada. So I'm pretty sure that you're a little too amped up right now.
Well, all right. So before we get into the game, you obviously follow the Canadian basketball scene closely. When is your prediction for when the Canadian senior men's team first defeats the senior USA team?
Ooh, well, you know, I'd like to say that all those youngsters will get a wealth of experience through osmosis, and it might happen in Brazil. But I would have to give it another four-year Olympic cycle, perhaps, before Canada defeats the U.S. at the Olympics. Although you're too young to remember, but back in my day, present national team coach Jay Triano, who's an assistant coach with the Portland Trailblazers, when he was leading the Canadian national team back in the day, they had an unbelievable victory over the U.S. at the World University Games in Edmonton. And that game still gets talked about.
Sounds made up.
No, it's true, because Jay and others to this day can still talk trash to Charles Barkley, Karl Malone, and many other future Hall of Famers and NBAers that were on that U.S. University Games team that Canada defeated way back when. So, well, we haven't beaten the post-Barcelona NBA U.S. team. It definitely, as you kind of foreshadow it, it will happen sometime, I think, over the next 4 or 5 year kind of Olympic cycle, that all these young NBA guys now, with many more coming up, will have a great opportunity to top the U.S. national team.
Yeah, well, you know, if you guys actually make the Olympics this time, that might happen.
No, and that's very, very true. It's going to be unbelievably difficult even to qualify, even with the number of players. With the U.S. winning, that at least frees up a spot that Canada might be able to sneak into. But the whole Tournament of the Americas is going to be very competitive down in Mexico, and we'll have to see whether this young group of Canadians can kind of rise above maybe where their experience level says they should be right now.
All right. Well, yeah, I'm sure people are waiting for us to get into the finals, so we should probably do that. I mean, it's certainly, I think in the World Cup, there should be a decent matchup. Another classic tonight, as the Warriors came back from down 11 with about 3 minutes left, I had my famous tweet, "Good night, Warriors," which I have now tweeted 3 times during the playoffs, and 2 times they've actually come back and forced overtime. So I'm a good luck charm. 99% win probability for the Cavs at that point, up by 10 according to InPredict. And did you think there was any chance that the Warriors could get back into it when they're down 11 with 3 minutes left?
Well, some people may say I'm lying. Yes, I did think they could, given the number of possessions. And they did exactly what I wanted them to do, actually, was foul Tristan Thompson and attempt to go for basically trading 3-for-1. And that happened 2 times in a row. I did think, given the style that Golden State plays, given how poorly they had shot to that point, that there was, regardless of the win probability, that they did still have a shot with the number of possessions, and it looked like the way they were going to play that game out. So I'm not totally making it up, but I did think that that they had a chance still to come back.
Yeah, no, it's I mean, they certainly have a history of doing that, especially once they get that small lineup on the floor. But so, I mean, overall, though, this is just a putrid offensive game for Golden State. To what do you ascribe that? Is that, were they just missing shots, or do you think that, you know, it was what the Cavs were doing more than that? I mean, if you're the Golden State coaching staff now, are you really concerned now at two pretty rough offensive games in a row?
Well, it's funny the way you ended that question, because I was going to say it wasn't just tonight. The offensively in game one, to me, they were less than ideal as well. So if I'm a Golden State coach, I don't think I'm too concerned. But having said that, I think a lot of analysts will go over this and say that it's just Golden State playing poorly, which I think discredits Cleveland and just how scrappy they're playing. But separate from the scrap and the heart and, you know, the next man stepping up, defensively, they're also doing some very good things. Steph Curry missed a lot of open shots, or what for him should be classified as open shots. But I like the way Cleveland is both stringing him out from sideline to sideline on the pick and roll, for instance. I like that when they've actually switched and had a big, normally only Tristan Thompson, I like how he's been able to play on Steph. And I've been disappointed that Steph's been turning down sometimes, turning the corner and driving. But you have to say Cleveland's done a very good job that way. The bigs for Golden State, other than the brief flurry by my man Mo Spites in game one, the bigs in Andrew Bogut and Draymond Green,
they've been
non-existent. So I think one of the things Golden State might have to look at from an offensive point of view is running a little more quick pick and pop with Draymond, see if they can get him off with a couple of threes, which he's passed up, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the same thing. I mean, they're leaving him. I mean, he's getting the ball at the foul line where he's normally deadly, and they're just, especially when Mozgov's in the game, they're just having him camp out under the lane, and Draymond is not really comfortable finishing over Mozgov. Bogut hasn't been able to get his diet of alley-oops, and they did a nice job of fouling him when he did get inside this game. I mean, I think they need to pop him to the three-point line and say, all right, you know, keep shooting these, like, you're a good shooter, but when he's only shooting 25% of the playoffs, that's kind of a little tougher, too.
It is tougher, and for the most part, Draymond Green's been short-rolling, we would call it, into that free throw line area. And normally when he receives the ball there, he's looking to alley-oop over the top, as you said, to Bogut, or he's looking for the one dribble and the kick to the corners. Cleveland's been taking that away. So as you said, rather than going short roll, if Steph Curry and Draymond can change the angle up a little bit of that high pick and roll, he should be able to pop back to three. Now, does that necessarily change anything if he can't hit a shot? No, but I think that's a little better strategy at this point than having him roll to that high post area, because he's not looking to attack there. He's not a guy that attacks the rim from that area. Off the dribble, full court, he will attack the rim, but so far he's been very reluctant to do that in the first two games. So I would look for a little more pick and pop action between him and Steph would be one thing offensively. And then the other thing I would look at if I'm Golden State, and this is a different definition of kind of the same thing, is what's called shorting the pick and roll. That's not the roller. That's using another man to circle towards the ball. So as Steph Curry comes off Draymond Green or Andrew Bogut.
So like what the Heat would do, what the Heat or what the Spurs did a lot against the Heat when they would trap the pick and roll last year, right?
Correct. What it means basically, it's a bit counterintuitive, but the other big man starts out on the same side under the basket or in the short corner as the pick and roll. As Steph Curry dribbles off that screen, the big man down low circles towards the same side as Steph Curry. So he's actually bringing his man away from where the roller would go. And then you bring him up the lane for a quick pass. And then he can then pass to the big man rolling, or even better, as that man rolls down the hoop and the help comes from the corner, is he can look to kick back out for a three. And if fans remember back, it's an old Phoenix Suns set, basically. It was called fist up short. And what they would do is they would rotate that second guy towards the man dribbling the ball, which you say, that's crazy. You're bringing a guy into the area where the ball is. But that's a quick way off the dribble to pass to him and beat that trap or stringing up Steph Curry. So that's the other thing I'd like to see them add. And I'm surprised, given that Alvin Gentry use that a great deal in Phoenix, that maybe that's something that Golden State looks to do, rather than have Steph Curry string out the big man on the switch or try and pass over a long double team. Make that quick pass, roll the man down, and then look for the three-point shooter in the area that you would call the back, so that the man comes from the corner on the weak side,
this is up to the wing,
and you look for that kick out.
This is my problem with that, though. I mean, you're still – all right, so let's say – you know, I assume you would have Draymond be the short guy and Bogut set the screen in that situation. Is that kind of
I would actually have Draymond set the screen in case he doesn't roll, in case he pops, and I have Bogut rotate up just because of his passing.
But you don't have to guard Bogut there, though, at the elbow is the problem, though, to me.
The guard starts in the corner and pops up if Draymond or Andrew Bogut roll hard to the hoop. He only pops up to take – that way his man has to make a decision. Do I crash down on the guy rolling to the hoop, or do I stick with the three-point shooter? If Draymond pops, and Steph Curry passed on the short to Andrew Bogut, Andrew Bogut could then pass it back to Draymond. Or he could pass it, who could then pass it to the corner. So it becomes a hockey assist situation. But I would just like to see that, because it would get the ball moving quickly off it and roll, especially they're not quite double teaming Steph all the time. They're changing the coverages, but they're definitely stringing him out. And that might be a way to introduce more passing and ball movement off of the pick and roll.
Yeah, I mean, I think especially when Mozgov isn't in the game, because I think Mozgov, if Bogut comes up to the elbow, Mozgov's just going to stand under the basket anyway, you know, and they'll just say, all right, you want to touch the ball at the elbow, Andrew Bogut, that's fine. You know, you want to throw it to Draymond Green rolling to the basket? Well, I'm still, like, right under the basket if I'm Mozgov. So let me ask you this. Would you have come back with Mozgov, or did you think that, you know, Black kind of did the right thing staying a little smaller with Thompson at center?
If it was me, I would have come back with Mozgov earlier. Tristan Thompson had, I thought, a tough game. He did a very good job switching, like I said, out onto Steph Curry, and he's very good at being able to contain a guard. But overall, I thought he had a pretty rough outing, and I thought Mozgov was outstanding. I had a chance the last year. Mike D'Antoni was in New York. I had a chance to be embedded with that team for about 10 days during the season. And that was Timmy Mozgov's first year. And I got to see...
Were you on the road trip when he got dunked on by Blake Griffin?
No, I was not. I was just...
He's come a long way since then.
Just in New York with them. And I've always been very impressed with Mozgov, both... his athletic ability, his ability to run the floor. You know, he had problems with his hands a little bit earlier in New York, but you could see that he had potential both as a rim protector, as someone who could zone up and wall off the key on pick and roll. And offensively, he can beat people down the floor, and he's become quite effective at catching in the low block as well. So I would have gone back to Mozgov myself.
Yeah, as a quick aside, by the way, you mentioned, you know, that he used to have trouble with his hands. He's improved. Like, as a coach, like, what kind of drills do you run with a guy when you're trying to develop him to improve his hands? Like, what do those drills look like?
Well, just as, with Timmy Mozgov as an example, Coach Dan D'Antoni would basically just run one-hand drills where You'd have him moving laterally and having to make a catch one-handed, much like you would run with a wide receiver, where the ball, he'd move across the key, come to a nice two-foot stop, and have to accept a pass, like a hard baseball-style pass, with one hand, cushioning it in, catching it, and then immediately flipping it back out. And you'd move him back and forth doing this with both hands. You'd be passing the ball from a distance of, say, 10 feet. And you would start off slowly and then have him move laterally quicker and quicker, having to focus in not on his feet, not on where he was in the lane, but on looking the ball into his hand one-handed and then flipping it back out. From there, you progressed to having him come to a nice two-foot stop on the catch, catching it with two hands. And again, much like a football wide receiver, doing it slowly to start, making him form a diamond with his fingers between his two hands, and cushion it in to his forehead, throw a overhead pass back out. So it was just simple things like that, getting him to slow down, first of all. Don't worry about his feet or his movement to start, but just worry about the ball into his hands. And it was just simple drills like that that seemed to improve Mozgov when he was having trouble. Now, having said that, I'm contradicting myself, because I've said to many people that if a guy has really bad hands, you don't even have time to work on it sometimes. But with Timofey Mozgov, Dan D'Antoni did a really nice job of doing simple movement drills and having him cushion the ball in one hand at a time and then both hands.
Yeah, all right. Well, so I agree with you. I think I would have come back with Mozgov. They actually stayed with Mozgov at center because he had that awesome first half, and he was guarding Iguodala, which I thought was a nice little wrinkle there.
It was a little Tony Allen wrinkle.
Yeah, exactly. That was and I mean, they didn't stick with it for that long. But it was, I thought that that was interesting. And, you know, Iguodala, he did hit that 1-3 during the comeback, which we'll get to. But I thought I would have tried that because Mozgov really was just so effective again. And then when he was out, especially during the comeback, they were getting a ton of offensive rebounds, especially with Thompson switched out so far from the basket. And then they were also, you know, able to get a lot at the rim. So I mean, Mozgov was their second, has been their second best player in this series. I think you got to at least give it a shot and see whether he can exist against that small lineup.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see how coaches react to that Golden State small lineup. You know, do they kind of stick with their own philosophy if you're a Memphis and not size down, you know, that's the way they play and they stick with it? Or, you know, Cleveland's obviously both a more fluid team in terms of how they can play, and just out of necessity with basically having a seven-man rotation, there's not a lot they can do. And I would have come back with Timmy, but you know, they wanted to match up with Golden State's small lineup, given how things went, I think, in game one. That might have been on their minds, the Cleveland coaching staff's minds, maybe a little too much. But that's the decision they made, and it's easy to second guess at this point. But maybe we'll look to see whether they space Mozgov's minutes a little better in game three back in Cleveland.
Yeah, so one of the key things, I mean, you know, people are going to focus on the comeback and the overtime, but, you know, Cleveland was fantastic throughout, especially on the offensive glass. I can't remember a game. I mean, I usually, when I do the stats during the game, I'll chart the number of offensive team rebounds that a team will get, you know, where either they knock the ball out of bounds off the other team due to contesting it, or, you know, they draw a loose ball foul. And Cleveland had 10 of those. So on the surface, they only had 14 offensive rebounds.
The differential off the top was just maybe four. But as you add in with those team rebounds, as you call them, it's a huge margin.
Yeah, so I mean, I think they had 24 total offensive rebounds and offensive team rebounds to 35 defensive rebounds for Golden State, and that's not going to cut it for Golden State, and that's how Cleveland was able to stay in this despite just horrendous shooting.
Yes, but that's been one of their trademarks the whole season, and I think had to be one of the biggest worries for the Golden State coaching staff coming into this finals. You know, people focus on fine Canadian boy Tristan Thompson. Speaking of being of the Canadian national team earlier, they focused on his ability to create a little chaos on the offensive boards. And what that does for Cleveland is that they can send Tristan Thompson to the boards, create more possessions and new opportunities for them while not getting torched in transition, because everyone else can be in a position to get back. It's a lovely little luxury to have. It's the best of both worlds in terms of creating more possessions, but also being in a good position to cut off transition. And if you're Golden State, you have to say now, looking at your small lineup and how that affects your rebounding percentages, you know, is that something that we need to adjust? Even though the small lineup has been so successful against this particular team, is that something that we need to vary or change in some way to even out those rebounding stats just enough? Obviously, if Golden State shoots like they normally shoot, it doesn't matter. But
yeah,
in this case, when they're not shooting like expected, the offensive rebounds become a huge bone of contention for them.
So if you're a coach, I mean, is there anything other than just from a personnel standpoint, is there much you can do schematically to try and give up offense or to take away offensive rebounds? I mean, I guess the only thing I could think of, which I wouldn't recommend doing, is just helping less at the basket. I mean, because that's how a lot of these offensive rebounds are occurring, and then just trying to get a little bit better box out technique. Like, one thing I didn't like, and we can, you know, I'm sure you have an opinion on this, I thought that the Golden State kind of devolved into a lot of face guarding, but they just weren't really effective in keeping Thompson off the glass that way, because you can't move a guy when you're face guarding him and he's already starting off too deep under the basket on that penetration. I think you need to turn around and get your butt on him. But, you know, what do you think about that? You're the coach and I'm not. So did you see that at all? Is there anything else they can do technique-wise?
The face guard, I guess I'll address the face guarding first. And to me, the only guy who was really doing much face guarding was Andrew Bogut, who was struggling as is. And if you face guard and move your feet effectively, you know, that theoretically allows others to come in and clean up the rebound, which is kind of the whole point. But Andrew was face guarding, but he was also then wrapping someone up sumo style, and that's where the fouls were coming in. Now, to stem the offensive rebounding in general, it's very difficult, because as you can see, when LeBron posts up or gets the ball in isolation on the wing, Golden State's natural reaction is to try and overload that side, the Tom Thibodeau style defense that's been adopted by many, and obviously Ron Adams was a big part of that when he was in Chicago. So Golden State's trying to send that extra defender over to LeBron's side, and then you have to zone up on the weak side as you are outnumbered. And that makes rebounding assignments very, very difficult. So for them to go away from the way they've played the majority of time in terms of flooding one side defensively, and normally it's fine because they switch so much and they're so long and so high that it's not a big deal. But against this Cleveland team, it's been very difficult for them to then find their rebounding assignments. And even on the last play, or on Dellavedova's offensive rebound, it was the same sort of thing, where a guy who doesn't normally go to the offensive boards, or shouldn't, right? He's a guard. He should normally be retreating into transition defense. But on that play, that's obviously not going to happen. Klay Thompson doesn't even kind of look around, and Dellavedova ends up going to the free throw line. So it's a very difficult situation for them. If they're not helping, if they're sending that guy over to the strong side and not zoning up and helping up from the weak side properly, then they're going to get burned by ball rotation. If they stay home a little bit more, keep guys off the boards, then it becomes individual rebounding battles. So Tristan Thompson may win out on that anyway, right? He's quicker. He's going to burrow in baseline. And one of the biggest things that Golden State can do is they're often getting driven too deep on their rebounding position. So,
yeah.
You know, find the man, or something as simple as finding your man earlier, little less ball watch as soon as you anticipate the shot going up, trying to establish yourself a little further out from the hoop so you're not getting pushed down too deep where Cleveland is getting the tips and the back taps and things like that.
Yeah, it's funny because Clay blamed himself for not boxing out Dellavedova on that last play. I actually, in rewatching it, looked like he was engaged with Tristan Thompson.
Yes.
And Dellavedova, I mean, you're normally not expecting that, right?
No, exactly. But it's not a normal situation, right? That's why,
exactly,
where everyone's going to be crashing in a situation like that. And, Clay was leaning basically on Tristan Thompson's legs from the back to keep him occupied. Dellavedova came in. It was almost like they were running an offensive line stunt, because Dellavedova came in right behind Thompson and then darted to the right where he ended up with the ball.
Well, it's, and when you're down like that, you know, with no shot clock, you might as well send everyone to the glass. You know there's not going to be a fast break the other way. Like, it's a desperation time. And I think it's funny, like, how often players don't crash the glass. Even if you're a point guard, like, get in there. You know, the ball's going to get tipped around. You might be able to get it. And he was able to draw that foul. I mean, I'm not sure really what else they necessarily could have done there. Maybe Barnes could have been a little more aggressive coming down from the top. He was the one who ended up fouling Dellavedova. But, you know, I mean, if you can send just as many guys to the offensive glass, especially when they're in a help situation, it's tough. You can't guarantee you're going to get that defensive rebound.
Oh, no, exactly. And the thing with that is that situational awareness, right? As you said, that no one's going to be fast breaking there. So you should literally see 10 people in the painted area by the end of that play, and you didn't.
So another schematic thing that I thought was really interesting from this game, the Cavs went much more often to a pick and roll involving James and whoever Curry was defending. They only, by my count, did that once in game one, very much towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
And as Blatt said in the post game press conference, they found something they liked. He didn't identify what that was, but that seemed to be it. What did you see on how that was being defended? And, anything that you think that Golden State could do differently stopping that play, because they really had a lot of trouble with that early in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, early in the fourth quarter they did, and it was more often Steph Curry originally was showing just briefly, and then they were trying to go under onto LeBron, and they did a terrible job of it originally. As the quarter went on, I thought Golden State actually did a pretty good job a couple of times. I would have just switched it. Make LeBron attack Steph. Steph can back up on him. You know, you're going to have help coming, etc. But when originally they tried to go with Steph showing, as a big man would, just stepping out and letting LeBron's man come underneath Steph, I thought they did a terrible job. And I actually made a note of it a couple of times that they really needed to communicate better. There was one where Steph appeared to be icing or blueing a high pick and roll or whatever color Golden State uses. I'd have to check on that. Oh, there it was. I just replayed it. It was with 7 minutes left. It was the one where LeBron got smashed in the face. And so at that point, Iguodala is covering LeBron, and James Jones is coming up to set the screen. He comes up as if he's going to set it on the right side of Iguodala, flips the screen to the left. Steph's already moving to the right and doesn't communicate to Iguodala at all. And that's where Draymond Green came and chopped some wood on LeBron's nose. And that was kind of a couple of times right around that 7-8 minute mark where they put Steph into pick and roll as much as they could, where Golden State did a poor job. But after that, for the rest of the fourth quarter, I thought they did a pretty good job on communicating, on Steph showing long enough so that someone could come under. If they were, you know, if LeBron wanted to shoot the pull up, it was there. But that's exactly what Golden State would be looking for in that situation. So, David Blatt, obviously, I think, was referring to throwing Curry into as many pick and rolls as possible. But, you know, I'd have to go over the individual numbers. But after the first couple of times, I thought Golden State did a much better job of playing that action and communicating on the floor what they were going to do.
Yeah, and you know, the Cavs obviously had their troubles scoring down the stretch. But, you know, I mean, ultimately, you know, we talk about the offensive rebound. We talk about the Curry and pick and roll. I mean, there are well over 100 possessions in this game. I think it was, I had like 103, and the Cavs only scored, what, like 96 points? Is that, you know, it's funny. They only scored 95 points. So Golden State's defense was fine. That's what Draymond Green said afterwards, that the offense is the issue. I went back and looked at Steph Curry's shots. I thought maybe 5 or 6 of them were tough shots for him. He had a couple of late clocks. There was another heave at the end of a quarter. But largely, it seemed like he was getting pretty similar looks that you would consider a good look, at least, you know, for
him.
Exactly.
You have to qualify that. Both Clay and Steph often what would be described as a good look for someone else.
Yeah.
That's not a good look for them. Their good looks are contested, are tough, but for them, they are good looks. And I thought Steph had a number of shots that I would qualify as Steph good looks.
Yeah, I mean, I think only like 5 or 6 of them, I would say, were notably harder than the shots that I regularly expect him to take. But he was just off. Like, he was missing way left a lot, which I didn't look too hard mechanically. He said he really just didn't feel right. He knew that the shots were way off when he was taking him. So, you know, I expect him to play a lot better in the next game. But yeah, that was definitely maybe I wouldn't say disturbing, because I think they're gonna say they're happy with those shots, don't you think?
Oh, I would agree, and I think there's no better example. Just look at his last shot on the step back, which ended up being an air ball. Well, the spacing was very crowded, and that's obviously the after timeout play that was drawn up wasn't executed very well. But when you go back and look at that type of shot, that's normally bread and butter for Steph Curry. And it was, as you said, I think it was overshot and wide right. It was a Buffalo Bills trifecta. And so,
yeah, that one was wide right.
To me, that was the best example of, you know, Steph was just off tonight, and that can happen to the greatest players in the world. The best shooter in today's NBA, that can happen to him. It's just the vagaries of the game, as it were. And Matthew Dellavedova, I think we need to give credit for
absolutely
for doing a pretty good job. I think just as much of Steph's tough shooting night needs to be chalked up to Steph. And that, well, you wouldn't think it's going to happen again. You know, Dellavedova did a very good job of fighting over screens. He did an especially good job when Golden State tried to move Steph Curry off the ball. He did a great job of locking on and trailing. And he also did a good job at something that you would think is very simple, but for most players is very difficult. And that's, you know, where a coach tells you, stick with that man. For most players, that's difficult, because all their lives they've learned how to set up the my man basket ball triangle. And sometimes they just can't help themselves from shading a little too far off to help, sure, moving. But Dellavedova did an excellent job of just staying with Steph Curry and not helping where you'd normally say he should be. So, you know, that was a very, very good job in my books. And like I said, it's a lot more difficult than you would think.
I thought he did a nice job of adjusting from game one, when I thought he got kind of lit up by Steph. He got a foul, he got back cut a couple of times. he did a great job of keeping his chest on him and still showing his hands after he got an early foul call in this game. And he also bodied up pretty well on switches late in the overtime as well, on Green and once on Iguodala. So he definitely had a great defensive game.
And that's the sort of thing that, you know, people love, because that shows all the grit and the heart and the intangibles that people are always talking about, right? It plays into the narrative how the white point guard from Australia should play. So, but having said that, he did a very nice job. And
he was terrible offensively. We can say that too. Like it's not like he's a great player without flaws. I mean, he was killing their offense for much of the game too.
But then, funnily enough, he hits that three and then gets that offensive rebound. So, timing's kind of everything in this case. And in that respect, he kind of came up big. But I would give him credit, and then I would give Steph credit for limiting himself as well in terms of his poor shooting night.
Yeah, Dele also got some really key loose balls at the end. I mean, he had one key
defensive score. Harrison Barnes is still standing upright and down on the floor, grabs the ball without injuring Kyle Korver, and gets the timeout as well, which was had great hustle and great heads up all at the same time.
Yeah, and James got on the floor for that one too. Green, the ball was kind of behind him. I don't know if it would have helped there. And Barnes. I mean, Barnes was in basically the same spot as Dele, and, Dele grew up in Australia and, played Australian rules football or whatever, and Harrison Barnes, that's not – he plays hard, certainly, don't get me wrong, but it's not really in his DNA, I don't think, to, dive head first on the ball the way it is for Dele.
Well, many people are pointing out the Aussie rules. See, I would point out that he more probably played rugby. Because that is
you Commonwealthers as a Australia being a fellow British Commonwealth state, I will cede to you since you're also from Canada.
Yeah, that's definitely like a ball coming out of a ruck of some sort, and the forwards have lost the ball, and here comes Dele, one from the line to dive on that ball, turn and secure possession till the rest of the big guys come in. So I'm chalking that up to rugby skills, not Aussie rule skills.
So there are a few plays I wanted to go over you with, especially because you do a lot of film breakdowns in your work. One of them was the play on which Curry tied the game after to send it into overtime before James missed that last layup. I really like that they went with no timeout there. Do you agree with that? Are you kind of a no timeout guy? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm a no timeout guy given the players that Golden State had on the floor and their ability to flow into to something before the defense is set. Yes, I am a no timeout guy. If I have Steph Curry with the ball, no timeout.
And, James went on to Curry a couple times late, and frankly, I don't think he's that effective on Curry. Would you agree with that?
I don't know if I agree or disagree. I'm kind of neutral on that one, mainly because Curry did an outstanding job of splitting when he came off the screen. And so, LeBron did his best to contain. They obviously weren't forcing him down the sidelines. There was no blue or ice situation where LeBron needed to be on Steph Curry's top hip and force him down. Thompson did a very good job, I thought, of showing and not giving a lot of space, but I had to give a lot of credit to Steph Curry for the way he basically came off the screen. It wasn't a low Chris Paul type of split, but he did a really good job of splitting. And it was funny, as he went to the basket for, kind of what ended up being a scoop finger roll type of layup, you could almost see him thinking to himself, oh, there's a little too much time. It was almost like he was delaying doing the layup to try and take more time off. So I thought that was more an outstanding offensive play by Steph Curry, and to get back to your original question, yes, I would have gone no timeout there as well.
Yeah, to me, it looked like they could, because I think that this might just be total extrapolation on my part. I think that they didn't quite know what they wanted to do there. You know, I think.
Didn't know what they wanted to do offensively or defensively.
No. I'm talking about defensively. Whether they wanted to switch that, or whether they wanted, you know, to try and string it out. It looked like, you know, because I think that James doesn't really defend ball screens that much, and so I don't know that they quite knew what they wanted to do. I mean, so maybe Thompson felt like, all right, you know, I'm not going to switch onto him and contain him because, you know, this is LeBron. Like, he wants to stay on him. He doesn't want me to switch onto him because he's taking him over. He's the guy who's going to stop him.
Well, yeah, if you go over the play, Draymond Green secured the rebound with 16.4 seconds left. And the way Cleveland was set up upon him grabbing it, he dribbled up to half court. Steph comes and gets it. Okay, you freeze the action at that point. Cleveland shaped up pretty good in terms of their defense. Other than, you know, Harrison Barnes was kind of cutting back door at that point. But, you know, they obviously weren't looking for a crazy pass. So LeBron is kind of angling sideline, and then Draymond Green comes in with a really effective drag screen about 2 feet above the three-point line. Now, here's the key. At that point, Tristan Thompson is below the level of the screen, so he's doing a good job. He's square up on the ball. His left foot was a little bit back. But the key to the play was Steph Curry comes directly off of Draymond Green's shoulder. And so LeBron is basically caught trying to come over top, and that allows Steph to take a hard dribble, get to the middle, and then that's when Tristan Thompson opened up because he had to try and show on it. So it was a tough situation, again, because it's coming out of the flow of the play, and that's why I like to see it. You know, that's the bedrock of the 7 seconds or less offense in Phoenix. Drag screens, double drag screens, get your shooters to the corners, which Klay Thompson wasn't quite to the corner, but he was deep enough that his man couldn't step up, which was Mike Miller at that point, I think. And
it was Dele, actually.
Oh, it was,
but yeah,
Dele.
They were putting Thompson in the strong side corner. I saw them, you know, direct him into the strong side corner.
Exactly.
A lot.
That's what you want. You want those shooters in the corner, and then
they were just refusing to leave him.
Yeah, you hit the ball with a drag screen and see what happens. And in this case, Golden State did an outstanding job. It was a good screen, but like I said, more importantly, Steph came off of it right off of Draymond's shoulder, and LeBron reached behind. That the biggest problem was LeBron gambled and reached behind like he was going for the steal. And that made Tristan Thompson have to take one step higher up, and that allowed Steph Curry to then split and go down the middle for the finger roll layup. Like, as soon as LeBron got caught, he turned and went for the old from behind flip of the ball. And that was the biggest problem defensively for Cleveland.
Would you have liked to have seen more help on the backside from Shumpert? And I think it was
J.R. Smith. Yeah, it was J.R. Smith and Shumpert on the weak side. If I'm anybody on that play, Shumpert was on Iguodala, who was probably 4 feet behind the three-point line at that point. J.R. Smith was running on a baseline cut with Harrison Barnes. If J.R. stays there, that's really, really tough because Harrison Barnes shooting the three from the corner.
Yeah, left corner.
I ideally would have liked to see Iman Shumpert in at the elbow area. I don't think you could get into the nail. And if you're going to force anyone to beat you with a three with 10 seconds left in the game, I'm pretty sure it's Andre Iguodala. But because it's out of the flow of the play, Nate, neither of those guys was getting there.
Yeah.
You know, looking at it on film now, You can Monday morning quarterback it all day long, but out of the flow of the play, and especially with J.R. Smith moving baseline with Harrison Barnes, you know, his head at that point is basically turned away from the play, and it makes it even more difficult for him to react properly or get into a help position where he could contest Steph Curry. But if that's the case, Steph's immediately kicking it out to Harrison Barnes.
Yeah, that's and then also they're down two, so you don't want to give up a three and lose the game necessarily. At least you can go into overtime and you've got the last shot with James. What did you see then on that next play where James missed the layup and then Thompson got the tap that almost went down?
Well, first of all, I'm pretty sure that LeBron got fouled at least twice before he got to the rim. Now, excuse me, with that amount of time remaining, I'm not sure that's ever going to get called. But it was tough. Golden State did a good job. Klay Thompson was shadowing the ball with Dellavedova passing it in, and they forced LeBron probably a good 4 feet higher than Cleveland ideally would have wanted him to catch the ball. So that's the first good thing that Golden State did. But then it was funny because rather than playing him square, Andre Iguodala drops his right foot and gets in a kind of push left stance, which is normally the exact way LeBron's been going most of the first two games. He's been pushing the ball.
And he reached too, like, which I thought was just like,
yeah, he jabs. Why do that? He fouls him right away. He's opened up the gate. Basically, he reaches in with his right hand and fouls him. He's hooked on LeBron's shooting sleeve on his right hand on the dribble. LeBron just powers through that. He gets fouled again with basically an offhand push. Andre Iguodala is now perpendicular to him at about the foul line, and he's riding him with his left hand. Again, not going to get called, but probably a foul. And then as LeBron gets to the hoop, it looks like he gets hit one more time. He's never going to get that call. He's so big, he's so strong, he's so quick that a lot of times the refs will just stare at that. Kind of, it's the old Shaq syndrome. When you're sure, big and strong, they look at it like, oh, you should finish. So I thought it was a great move, and I 100% thought LeBron was finishing left-handed. And then Tristan Thompson goes up for that tip, and it's just unfortunate the way his body was positioned. He was going in to tip it left-handed. If his body had been positioned just a little bit differently, I think he would have tipped that right-handed and it would have been game over.
Yeah, well, maybe he can, next summer or over the summer, he can switch to only tipping with his right hand instead of the left hand.
Hey, that for the most part, him switching to shooting his free throws, et cetera, right-handed, statistically, it's a little bit better, but I'd say it's worked out quite well. And here I'm going to give a Canadian shout out because the shooting coach that restructured his shot and changed it from left-handed to right-handed is a shooting coach out of Calgary by the name of David Love, and who's worked with a number of NBA guys now. So I have to give a shout out to Coach Dave Love, who's done a very good job working with Tristan and a few others in terms of their shooting mechanics.
One thing I really liked in this game I thought that they actually, in a lot of cases, defended the ISOs with LeBron a little bit better, especially once Green was in at the center. They were able to force him baseline, and then Green was able to get over there with the help. And I had advocated for that in the podcast after game one to try and send him baseline because you limit his available passes basically just to that weak side corner or, maybe to someone coming down the lane. What do you think? Do you like kind of sending him baseline there? Or are you more
I saw your tweet on it because right when you tweeted, I had tweeted out, I think, previously about Festus Ezeli 2-9-ing basically to the wrong spot and being late to come to that baseline side. to show LeBron. If you force him baseline, it also takes away his field of vision in terms of the double coming and also of his passing angles. Now, LeBron is such a freakish passer that I think forcing him baseline, you know, he could thread the corner pass for the three if that's open, and he could also probably hit the 45, the above the break three on the weak side. He could probably hit that pass as well, but he's doing that out of basketball IQ, not out of actual vision of the play most of the time. So I like sending him that way. Also, if you send him that way, the shots that you leave open to him are a step back fading away baseline, which I think is a much more difficult shot. And he also, if he gets pushed to the middle, it also allows him to kick it back up top on the same strong side and then repost in a lower, more advantageous position. Now, Cleveland doesn't do a very good job of getting him the ball if he reposts, but you take that away from him as well. So for the most part, I agree with you that I would try and send him baseline, and especially if you can push him out on the initial post up so it's a mid-post catch or higher, then you can also send that guy baseline side and overload the side like we were talking about earlier.
Right, yeah. I thought Azili really struggled today. What do you think?
He did, and like I said, defensively what caught my eye was when LeBron was down there, Festus was trying to clear, so he didn't get a defensive three-second call. He was trying to clear high to where his man actually was, rather than I would have cleared right back to LeBron's side on the key or looked to tag off on someone, if possible, across the lane. So, you know, clear off 8 feet one way rather than 10 feet up top, which puts you in a bad position to come down again. So, you know, that was one thing that I was disappointed in seeing. But with them going with the small lineup, you know, the minutes for Golden State's deep bench basically evaporated. And so while I was disappointed with Festus a little bit, he wasn't going to get a lot of time regardless.
I really liked what they got from Sean Livingston in this game. Do you think that there's a place for him to play more?
Yeah, I think definitely if you want to go with that mid-80s Louisville Cardinal lineup where everyone's the same size, which Golden State has done, and that's, you know, given them the opportunity to be able to switch and switch and switch, I think Golden State is concerned with Livingston in that the switch is going to end up being on LeBron. And while I think he obviously has the length and the defensive intelligence to cover LeBron, I feel Golden State thinks that he's going to be overpowered in any situation.
Yeah.
So while he can play, it's tough for him to play the traditional role he did during the regular season, where he's running the point and anchoring a lineup without either Curry or Thompson on the floor. Normally it was just one of them during the regular season that would stay on and play with the Sean Livingston unit. So all those things kind of come into play. And I think Golden State's a little bit afraid that he gets thrown into the pick and roll with LeBron, and LeBron either overpowers him off the dribble or immediately runs to the block and posts him up.
All right. Well, so we probably got time for one more here. That last play, so first of all, you know, Delvedove, we talked about that play where he gets the loose ball foul, makes the two free throws. Golden State is down one. There's 10 seconds left. Then you only have one timeout remaining. Are you taking your timeout then and advancing the ball, or are you going to just bring it full court and think, all right, if I miss, then I can call timeout, after free throws on the other end? I mean, it's kind of tough, you know, going full court either of those times with 10 seconds left, it's a tough choice to me.
Oh, and that's why Steve Kerr's getting that big cake, Nate. No, it's a very difficult situation and easy to second guess. I honestly can't say, looking back on it at this point, that I would have done the opposite. I would have taken the timeout and advanced the ball. Just because with 10 seconds left, I want to get the best look possible. And it didn't seem like kind of an organized chaos type situation where you'd be able to get that solid drag screen with people confused or anything like that. So I would have taken the time out, much like Steve Kerr did. Now, having said that, the Golden State Warriors have done an unbelievable job on ATOs or after timeout plays all season. And unfortunately, this time around, not so much. It looked like they were not confused as much as the execution wasn't there. And just playing it back now, I've just got to that point, so I can literally walk right through it now. And I would have liked to have seen they basically set it up with Steph coming up off a screen and then curling around. But what it ended up doing is setting up some very poor spacing. And you had Klay Thompson at the top, Steph at the elbow. Steph basically turns like he's setting a down screen for Harrison Barnes, but he got the ball in a good situation. He drove to the left towards where the help was, which was Shumpert on Klay Thompson. But to me, the shot, it was still a very, for Steph Curry, it was a very good shot. It didn't go like Golden State wanted it. I think they would have liked him to get the ball up higher, and I would have liked to seen him get the ball on the move as opposed to catching into a two-foot stop. But what they thought, it was a situation that they liked to do. I think they ideally wanted Steph to set a back screen as opposed to circling. Like, they wanted him to walk down underneath Harrison Barnes, set the back screen, and then curl up. But what it ended up being, it was like a pin-down screen. And then he curled off, and it kind of threw the spacing off. But in the grand scheme of things, I still thought the shot was a good look for Steph Curry.
Yeah, I think so too. And one of the things that I thought was really key to that play was James Jones had excellent pressure on the inbounder, which really prevented them from getting the exact angle they wanted. I think that Steph was forced to go a little bit more towards the baseline to give the passer the angle, and then Klay was in that corner, and it just kind of mucked up the spacing. It was just a little bit too low. Maybe, you would say it would be nice for him to go middle and try and use the screen from Green, but then, you worry they're going to trap you, and now you're going to have Draymond Green taking that shot, and you're Steph Curry, and he got a good look. So
yeah, and the very, very good observation about the strong on-ball pressure on the pass. And here's who I'll say is at fault in this case on that. And that would be referee Tony Brothers, who's standing 4 feet away. And normally, and you'll see this on every sideline out of bounds play, especially late in the game, what does the referee do when he talks to the defender?
He tells him you got to be 3 feet back.
Yeah, exactly. And James Jones is literally almost standing out of bounds. He's right up and Tony Brothers is staring right at
the play. I can't remember the last time I ever saw that called, though, so no, good play by him.
You can literally, James Jones, and I'm replaying it right now for the benefit of all the podcast listeners, because I know they can all see this. Theater of the mind. But James Jones is literally standing on the out-of-bounds lines, extended up, contesting the pass. And Tony Brothers can blow his whistle and move him back, which is exactly what he should be doing. And I'm guessing no one else noticed that except for you. You're the only man in North America who noticed that. But it's a great job of defending the ball, but it's also illegal.
All right. Well, that's any other kind of big themes that you saw out of this game that you wanted to comment on that you had in your notes before I let you go?
Not particularly, other than I think Cleveland will continue to try and force the ball out of Steph Curry's hands, regardless of how poorly he shot in this game. That's something they'll continue to try and string him out laterally on pick and rolls, and with Tristan Thompson, they will switch on, and Tristan Thompson's done a very good job of defending that for the most part. So I think Cleveland will continue to do that. Golden State, offensively, yes, Cleveland's done pretty good job defensively, but I think Golden State will look to simplify things like they did, much like they did at the beginning of the year when they were very turnover prone, and they haven't been too turnover prone. They had some lackadaisical ones, both Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, but I think they'll look to simplify, get out and push the pace a little bit more. You know, obviously they'll have to deal with the offensive rebounds, both of Tristan Thompson and the team ones you talked about, the kick out, the tip outs, the balls out of bounds, things like that. They'll really need to do a better job. But I think they need to get out in transition more, and they need to simplify more. And then Steph Curry especially, get to the hoop early. And that'll open up not your three-pointers, but the corner threes for Klay Thompson, for Harrison Barnes. I think will lead to him being a little more relaxed, and you know, that'll lead to the defense sagging back, zoning up, and Steph being able to shoot off high pick and roll for the three once they've opened up with a little more, like he did on that basket where he split the pick and roll. I think, and there was another couple of occasions where he got to the hoop and kicked out rather than finishing himself. So those are kind of simple themes I would look at if I'm Golden State.
Yeah, to me, I think that a lot of Golden State's kind of flow and off-ball stuff was really disrupted in this game. Like the DHOs just didn't work at all. I thought that the Cleveland perimeter guys did an awesome job of taking those away, and they also still managed to not really get beat backdoor either. I mean, whether it was through some creative holding or, you know, just cutting off the angles really well. I thought, like, Shumpert and Dellavedova were both fantastic, and Klay was really only able to get going when JR was on him, I thought.
Yeah, the dribble handoffs, definitely, and that's one of the areas where they've been able to neutralize a very effective part of Andrew Bogut's regular season play, is dribble handoffs, using that to free Andrew Bogut up and use his passing ability. And all Cleveland's been doing is obviously Mozgov or whoever has been playing off, letting Andrew Bogut handle up there. And then Cleveland's been doing a great job, as you mentioned, of sticking on the cutter, staying attached, and especially fighting over any of the little Andrew Bogut stick out the butt maneuver screens. Sure. That free guys up for the little curls from the top and cuts down the middle for backdoor passes. And Cleveland's done an excellent job, and that's definitely neutralized Andrew Bogut's passing effectiveness and has got him off the floor for big stretches when Golden State has been forced to go small.
Yeah, Cleveland said that they were going to be much more aggressive on guys and make them feel them, and that's exactly what they did. I thought also just their ball pressure was excellent, and just forcing and ball denials forcing the Golden State to start the offense a little bit further away. And then the further you are from the hoop and the more ball pressure there is, that takes away those back doors as well.
Yeah. And just to counter that, what Golden State needs to do is they need to kind of tilt the floor on semi-transition. The old Phoenix Suns series, which is called 21, which is a pass from your point guard to your two-man. In this case, Steph Curry would hit Klay quickly and then cut through to the corner, and then the drag screen comes for Klay Thompson. And so you put that into play, hit that earlier, and that's where you can be effective with dribble handoffs when it's guard to guard rather than hitting the trail big man. And he becomes the delay and goes into the dribble handoff. Maybe look for Golden State's guards to initiate more dribble handoff action on the sideline into pick and roll and get some movement that way, because you can also then set pin down screens on the far side, you know, on the weak side, and draw some attention on those actions, you know, to keep the help defenders at bay. So maybe look for Golden State also to try and run that 21 series a little more effectively, rather than looking for dribble handoffs on the delayed reverse to the big man.
All right. Well, he is Doug Everhart. Thank you so much for coming on. It's good to get a real coach on here instead of an amateur coach like me. we will see you around, have you back on, hopefully before the inevitable Canadian takeover of world basketball on the international stage. So tell us, where can we find you on Twitter? You're also another good in-game follow as well.
My Twitter handle is ebhoops, E-B-E, hoops. And always enjoy the observations and conversations on Twitter. And other than that, I'd love to come back, Nate. Thank you for having me. And hopefully next time I come on, I might have some news about summer league employment and things like that. So there's my tease.
All right, man. Well, yeah, we'll see you in summer league for sure. Thanks again for coming on. You can follow me on Twitter at Nate Duncan NBA. The Dunked On podcast is available on Real GM. You can subscribe via iTunes or through your favorite podcast player. Giving us a rating on iTunes is always much, much appreciated. That'll help us keep this podcast going. Thanks again to Coach for coming on, and we will talk to y'all next time. Till then.